Welcome Dan Schmutter, Eric Friday, Miko Temsky, David Siegel, David Jensen, and Paolo Capanna. And a big round of applause because he came from New York to Detroit and took a train down to Chicago. See, he deserves a real round of applause. That is duty and dedication to the Second Amendment. So we just have a few more people coming in because this is a really important panel. So I want everybody to, since this is a novelty, I will ask Paloma to start because we'll go with ladies first. Thank you.
Thanks to Julianne. So I don't want to do one-upmanship, you know, that just feeds into the stereotype of a litigator. But yesterday morning when I got to the airport in Rochester, New York, and I learned that my flight was canceled, I laughed out loud. I laughed enough that I'm really amazed that TSA let me out of the airport. Because I'm the woman who showed up with three monster-sized suitcases full of these booklets that then I ran around this morning, you know, to distribute to everybody's seat because, of course, we're late. Because the printer only had them ready the day before at 4 o'clock. So I instantly look at the ticketing agent and I say, I'll take a refund. She says, oh, no, I can fly you out at 4 o'clock. I said, no, that's the last flight of the day. Your next flight is tomorrow at 3. I'm going to miss talking at the Gun Rights Policy Conference. Now, let me just tell you, not that I'm at all sassy and not because I shoot 308. Every single person who was there complaining and hollering and yelling at the ticketing agents suddenly froze. And what do I say? I got two extra seats. Who's coming? So I hop in my car, and the 10-hour drive amounts to this. 10 hours of strategy and tactics. Okay, I call the girlfriend in Cleveland. Beth, where are you? I might need you. If my car breaks down, you're leg one. Stay by the phone. I pass Cleveland, Layla, South Bend, Indiana. I know people everywhere. Layla, stay by the phone. I might need you. The car might break down. I pass South Bend. I think, oh, God, I'm coming close to Chicago. A couple friends let me know that the news was that there was a fire over here at the airport. Yeah, I have news for the mayor. We got here. And as I drove under the overpass that welcomed me to Chicago with the mayor's name on it, I pointed out that we have a right to assemble, we have a right to free speech, and we do have a right to keep and bear arms. And I apologize, let me get to substance, but 10 hours, I was just hoping y'all would appreciate a bit of humor when I stood up. All right, look. This is probably the most critical moment that the Second Amendment has faced since 1791. In 2013, the New York State Legislature passed the SAFE Act, and within 2 months, two other states, Connecticut and Maryland, had done the same. It essentially amounts to rekindled versions of the 1994 assault weapons ban, a piece of legal fiction created by the federal legislature that had the intelligence to actually expire on its own and go away. And if we thought that we had a victory when Senator Feinstein's Senate Bill 150 could not even get past Senator Reid, we were sadly mistaken that these three cases brought in New York, Connecticut, and Maryland to declare these gun bans unconstitutional would be anything short of potentially federal gun control law through the judicial branch. These three cases are barreling like a freight train, gaining speed, going uphill. Some of the most famous decisions in U.S. Supreme Court history have taken up to 14 years, and litigants have died while their cases were pending. We are talking about reaching the U.S. Supreme Court potentially if they accept one or more of these cases in less than 2 years on the calendar. I would be a little bit less afraid of these cases reaching the U.S. Supreme Court if Justice Scalia hadn't taken such a liking to U.S. v. Miller. Because U.S. v. Miller essentially was a case concerning a failure to pay a tax under the National Firearms Act that turned into the first bit of judicial activism on gun control, wherein the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, what use do we have for a particularly configured firearm? So now fast forward to next year, if one or more of these three cases is accepted to SCOTUS, and we may actually see something come out of the high court that will make Senator Feinstein proud. Heller left the door open for the what. It declared the right fundamental, but Justice Scalia specifically said, I leave to a future day which firearms will be protected under the Second Amendment. So we're talking about manufacturers, we're talking about models, we're talking about features, we're talking about characteristics. The common use standard is common to just about every firearms off the modern assembly line. Part of what I do is work with manufacturers of firearms and ammunition. We passed the 100 million in production mark 2 years ago. Nobody even noticed it go by. Everything is in common use. And what the gun control advocates would have us say is that the AR platform is akin to an assault weapon with no attention to detail. So what's part of what we have to be doing? We need to learn a couple new tricks. We need to understand that the amicus brief is one of the most powerful tools that we are underutilizing. Amicus means friend. It is a way of doing judicial lobbying. It's an opportunity to put anywhere between 7,000 and 8,000 words, which, trust me, it's very long, it takes a while to write, in front of the justices at every level, at the district court level, at the circuit court of appeals level, and all the way to the United States Supreme Court. You do not have to be a party. You do not have to be someone funding one of the major pieces of litigation. You merely have to be in a position to offer something fresh, essentially expert level, and that the court should take into consideration in its decision-making process. When NYSRPA versus Cuomo was at the district court level, there were a few amicus briefs that went in. Most notably, Remington Arms submitted one. The first time that a United States manufacturer of firearms actually jumped in to a lawsuit in this capacity. Groundbreaking. And for those FFL 0708s who are in the audience, and I know you're here because I've seen you walking around in company gear, do please find me. Because part of what we will be doing to SCOTUS, specifically in support of the motion for cert in NYSRPA versus Cuomo, is to bring an amicus brief to support that motion, to say that the High Court should, because this issue is sufficiently critical, because this issue amounts to a de facto ban. One of the cases that I work on right now in New York is a gentleman who was charged with felony possession of an assault weapon for owning an SKS with a non-detachable magazine. Now, the statute is clear. The first point in analysis is having a detachable magazine. Yeah, you hear that room go silent at the thought you could be charged with felony and your law enforcement officer on the scene doesn't know either the statute or the firearm with sufficient expertise to ensure that your rights are being carefully protected, even at the same time that they're being infringed. The gentleman from California who spoke earlier, I came up with a funny little line for that. You know things are bad in New York when people in New York start talking about moving to California. In upstate, we view you as a gun-friendly state. I have news for you, right? Another part of what we're doing with that brief is we are bringing together an actual coalition. To Mr. Wallace, who talked about modulating your message earlier, we need to normalize and bring a face to just who is a law-abiding gun owner. The last 40 years of judicial decisions have largely focused on criminal defendants under the Armed Career Criminals Act, where judges did not care about the Second Amendment when put up against someone with 30 and 40-year criminal records for illegal use of firearms. Only because I'm with such close friends will I sort of do this tongue-in-cheek. If that isn't proof that gun control legislation is ineffective, I don't know what is. But suffice to say that our brief will go in with roughly 50 groups supporting, showing support from everything from sportsmen to ranges to gunsmiths to manufacturers. We want to show the United States Supreme Court that we are not a minority, that we represent core values of the United States Constitution, and that the Second Amendment, as my hero James Madison penned it, is still alive and well. Thank you.
Okay, so I have six attorneys up here. Now I have five, so I figured that I could throw something in the air. So I decided the next person who wins the mic is Dan Schmutter because he practices in New Jersey and New York.
Oh, you've got time in there. Okay, very good. Hi, my name is Dan Schmutter, and as Julianne said, I practice in New Jersey and in New York. And I thought I would recap a few of the New York cases that I've been involved in this past year, and then I'll talk about a very good development in New Jersey that you all know about by now. It's been mentioned a couple of times already, but I'll give you a little bit of the nuts and boltsy legal analysis of what actually happened. So let me start with a case that is mostly over, and we had a very nice result in called Osterweil versus Bartlett. That was our case which successfully challenged New York's ban on handgun possession by part-time residents. So if you were a so-called snowbird, that is, you had your principal residence, let's say in Florida, but you spent summers at your home in New York, New York had for 20 years had a rule that you could not obtain a permit to possess a handgun in your home. We challenged that rule, and we filed a complaint in federal court, and eventually the state of New York had to back off of that position because it seemed clearly in contradiction to and in conflict with the Heller case. But not only did we get New York State to back off, we got the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, to rule clearly that a part-time resident does have a right to apply for a handgun permit and to possess a handgun in their home. So that was a very nice result. We were very pleased with that. At this point, we are applying for an award of attorney's fees because under the federal civil rights statute that we're proceeding under, the prevailing party is entitled to an award of counsel fees. And so we filed that in March, and they were kind enough to tell us that the judge wouldn't get to it until the fall. So here we are in the fall. So we're hoping for a ruling on our counsel fee application any day now. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully that will we'll prevail on that. Another case that we're involved in is a case that you've probably heard about as well called Knife Rights versus Vance, which is a lawsuit against New York City and the Manhattan District Attorney challenging their unconstitutional practice of arresting ordinary folks carrying ordinary folding pocket knives. They allege that these ordinary knives, which I'm sure a lot of people here are carrying right now, are gravity knives, illegal gravity knives, even though they bear no resemblance to true gravity knives. And what they'll do is they will arrest people if at any time anyone can open the knife with a flick of their wrist. That they consider a gravity knife. Now, the problem is that the ability to do that varies dramatically from person to person. If someone is stronger or if someone has greater dexterity, they might be able to open a knife with the flick of their wrist that someone else couldn't. And that's kind of a huge problem if you don't know that your knife can be opened up with a flick of the wrist. It varies from specimen to specimen. You may have a particular model of knife, and that one might be openable with a flick of the wrist, and the other one might not be. And you could be in a store, and you could have two models of the same knife, two different specimens of the same knife. One could be deemed illegal in New York City, and one might not be. And it also varies with the age of the knife. A knife might open more readily if it's 5 or 6 years old and used a great deal, as opposed to if it's brand new. And all of this can subject you to arrest and prosecution in New York City. Now, the problem with this is sort of, I think, is best illustrated by the experience of one of our plaintiffs, John Copeland. Now, Mr. Copeland is an artist, and he shows his work around the world in various galleries. And like most people who carry knives, he carries it as a tool to cut canvas and to do various things like that. Well, he bought a Gerber brand folding knife. And not once, but twice, showed it to New York City Police Department officers and asked them whether it was legal. And both times the officers tried to open it, and they couldn't open it with a flick of their wrist, and they concluded that it was perfectly fine, and they handed it back to him. And he said, okay, that's fine, so I guess this is a legal knife. Well, the problem is his next encounter with the NYPD was not so good. The officers there could flick the knife open with their wrist. They promptly placed him under arrest. And the problem with that is that you can, no matter how many times you try to figure out whether the knife that you're holding is this so-called gravity knife that they think you can open up with the flick of your wrist. If you can't open it with the flick of your wrist, and if the guy, at the store that you bought it from can't open it with the flick of the wrist, and two police officers can't open it with a flick of their wrist, you still have no idea if the next day you could be arrested for possessing an unlawful gravity knife, because any police officer you encounter on the street might be able to do that. It's impossible to know whether you've got a legal knife under this practice. And because of that, and because it's impossible to know whether you're in compliance with the law, the practice violates the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that is our constitutional challenge to this enforcement practice. Well, the trial court dismissed our lawsuit in the district court, ruling that our claims were speculative because we didn't allege in our complaint the specific knives that the plaintiffs wanted to carry, which they thought were a problem. The problem with that is that if you can't know which knives are legal and which knives are illegal, and if you can't know which knives are going to get you arrested, you can't allege in the complaint which knives you want to carry, because it sort of puts the whole lawsuit on its head. And so we're up on appeal before the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, which is based in New York, the case is fully briefed. We're expecting oral argument anytime between now and January, and we'll see how that goes. So we're we feel like we've got a very good position, and we're hoping that we'll have a nice result. So we'll let you know how that goes. All right, let's now move to New Jersey. So usually the best news you can get out of New Jersey is when we beat back really bad bills and prevent them from becoming law and making the law even worse than it already is. But on Wednesday we had some really good news, and of course you've already heard a little bit about this, and I'm sure you've read it in the news and you've been following it, and that has to do with what happened involving Shanine Allen. Ms. Allen, as you may know, is a single mother, and she got caught up in New Jersey's very harsh web of gun laws when she drove from her home in Philadelphia, where she had a permit to lawfully carry a handgun, and she was on her way to Atlantic City in New Jersey for a birthday party, and what she didn't realize was that her permit was not valid in New Jersey, and therefore, she had her gun with her. She was stopped for a traffic stop. She voluntarily told the police officer that she had a permit and that she was carrying a handgun, and of course they promptly arrested her for unlawful possession of a handgun. Now, in New Jersey, the mere possession of a handgun is a very serious crime if you don't have a carry permit. The law used to be somewhat different, but in 2008, they made mere possession of a handgun without a permit as bad as possessing a weapon for an unlawful purpose or to be using it in a crime. So I think you heard before, the possession of a handgun is now a second-degree crime in New Jersey that carries a 3.5-year minimum mandatory sentence up to 10 years in prison with a presumption of incarceration. Now, what happened here was the law was upgraded to include something what's called the Graves Act, which was intended to make serious gun crimes subject to very little flexibility with respect to the prosecutor. Prosecutors were required to do certain things, were not allowed to give leniency, and so what they did was they basically took what is a mere possession law, which in most places is a relatively minor crime, and they made it into an extremely serious crime involving incarceration. Well, there is a program in New Jersey called Pretrial Intervention, PTI, which is a program for first offenders, and it's designed to allow people to avoid prison when they clearly don't possess any real, represent any real danger to the public. They just happen to get caught up into the legal system, but they don't really represent any danger. Well, of course, Shanine is represented by attorney Evan Knapp, and Evan applied to get her into the PTI program, and the prosecutor opposed it, and the judge denied it. And this is the same prosecutor that allowed Ray Rice into the PTI program after he punched the lights out of his then-girlfriend. So he avoided jail time for a violent crime, and Shanine Allen had to go to jail for a mere possessory crime for something she didn't even know was illegal. Well, Evan got the word out, and the story got some serious traction, as we heard Frank talk about it, and we heard Scott Bach talk about it as well. And on Wednesday, the New Jersey Attorney General issued a directive to prosecutors. And what the directive does is it requires that prosecutors throughout the state apply the Graves Act in a way that prevents this very problem. And the directive applies where three things are true. The handgun was lawfully acquired in the person's home state, the possession would have been legal in their home state, and the person thought that possession was legal in New Jersey. So it shifts from a presumption in favor of incarceration to a presumption in favor of no incarceration. And not only does that help Shanine, but that also will help similar people in similar situations visiting New Jersey from out of state. And it's a very good day for New Jersey, although it doesn't help New Jerseyans, it helps anybody visiting New Jersey. So we've got that going for us, which is nice. Thank you.
Okay, next I'd like to ask David Jensen. So since David Jensen is practiced in New York and Illinois.
Well, hello. Like Julianne said, I live in New York. I actually also practice in New Jersey. But my background is in the year 2008, when District of Columbia v. Heller came down, I was working in a corporate litigation department in a large law firm in New York City, and I've owned guns since I was 12, and I'm not from New York originally. And 2 years later, McDonald came down. I was very much paying attention to both, and about a year after that, I filed my first Second Amendment case, which was a challenge out in New Jersey. Not too long after that, I put together a case you've probably heard of called Moore versus Madigan. Now, most of the time when I've come out and spoken at these types of things in the past, I've kind of made it a, you know, war stories, and then I told the judge this. What I wanted to actually do today is give a little bit more of a circumspect discussion. And the topic is, I think it was winning Second Amendment freedoms in the courts, one lawsuit at a time, something like that. Just based on the background I just gave you, you know, one of the things that really jumps off the page is that the gun cases are different. When I compare the gun cases to other, and I don't have any background doing criminal law, all of my background has been civil litigation and almost entirely in U.S. federal court. Even though the gun cases are also civil litigation, and even though they also take place in federal court, there are a couple of unique challenges that come up with the gun cases. And the first and probably the most obvious one is guns are a political issue. Other things aside, guns are an issue on which reasonable minds can differ. And what that means is when you are walking in and you are presenting a case to a judge in, say, Manhattan or Chicago, there's a very good chance that you are presenting your argument to someone who, at an ideological level, does not agree with you and, for that matter, thinks you might just be a little bit crazy. The second thing is that there's a fair amount of play in the joints right now. And that's not because it's the Second Amendment. It's simply because it's a developing area of the law. But when I'm handling commercial cases for clients, even when you get thorny legal issues, there's generally precedent. There's other authorities you can go to. And when you get done doing the work, a lot of times you have a good idea of where a legal dispute should end up. How, if the court is applying the law and looking at the facts, the result it should come to. And frankly, 80 or 90% of the time, you're right on that. In the Second Amendment cases, you're not getting 80 or 90%. If a judge wants to rule against you, there are a lot of places where they can find to hang a hat and come down and issue a series of alternative rulings, whatever, but get to the result that you lose. And a final reason is that it's political at a second level for the judges. Okay, all of these federal judges are getting appointed by presidential administrations. And different presidential administrations and different political parties at a national level take some different views on these issues. So when you're in front of, and I said I wasn't going to do war stories, but I'm going to do one. When we had Moore at the district court level, you know, Judge Myerscough, my assessment was, quite frankly, among district court judges, she was the most receptive to the argument we were making. She was also an Obama appointee, and put it bluntly, she's young enough that in a future Democratic administration, she could potentially be appointed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So when you look at it in that perspective, that is yet another challenge you're dealing with, which is that a judge is, frankly, a judge in that position, I think, is going to understand that there is a very significant chance they are cutting off the ability or significantly damaging the ability to get appointed in the future. And what that taken all together means is that when you are running these gun cases up, the outcome gets a little unpredictable. And so while it's true we've had some good successes, quite frankly, we've also had some bad rulings, and in some cases, some shockingly bad rulings. And, you know, as I stand here, and it's now, I don't know, what, about 4 years or so later since this whole charade began, you know, one thing I find myself thinking, especially over the past year, is, you know, if a case is going to ultimately lose, is it even worth bringing? Because, you know, obviously when you're putting a case together, you think it has merit or you wouldn't be putting it together. And obviously you don't know how it's ultimately going to work out. But even if you somehow could know, you know what, at the end of the day, this is going to be a close ruling, but the appellate court's ultimately going to rule against us. The Supreme Court's not going to want to hear the case, what have you. Would it still be worth bringing that case? And the answer to that, the thing that I come back to, and I kind of wonder to what extent this has a little resonance with the audience, but what it comes back to me is I think that to a large extent, we're litigating not for right now, but for the next 100 years. And as I was thinking about my comments up in my room a little while ago, I got on the internet, and I wanted to actually get some numbers to go along with the general social observation. In 1850, the population of the United States was 23 million people. By 1900, it was 76 million. 1950, 151 million. 2000, 281 million. All right? That is over a 12-fold increase in 150 years. And what's going on at the same time is that this population increase is an urban increase. We're becoming an increasingly urban society. You know, it's not a coincidence that when Michael Bloomberg first started to drop millions of dollars trying to destroy our freedoms, he said, I'm going to start out getting people in cities to help me out. And this population explosion, frankly, it coincides a lot with the issues we're dealing with now. I think the point would be subject to debate, but in my opinion, the modern era of gun control began in 1906 when Massachusetts enacted a law that prohibited the carry of handguns in any form or in any place, including within your home, without a license, and mandated that authorities could issue or refuse to issue the license based on their determination of whether or not someone had a, quote, good reason. And very shortly thereafter, in 1911, New York followed with the Sullivan Law, a complete prohibition on all possession of handguns without a license under a similarly discretionary standard. And in, I believe it was 1922, New Jersey, no. Yeah, it was 1922. New Jersey followed suit. And what was going on at the same time was that in 1905, the Kansas Supreme Court had essentially created a ruling relying on nothing but a single academic citation that the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, does not secure any individual right. That ruling from 1905, which was essentially unprecedented and which was then rubber stamped by outcome-oriented courts all over this country, facilitated these changes that frankly started the next year in 1906. And frankly, those trends are continuing to date. The population continues to grow, and it continues to become more urban. So in that context, what do all these cases stand for? Obviously, if you win the case, hey, you won the case, you've got a ruling, it's stare decisis on that issue going forward in the future. I think we can be somewhat confident that Illinois won't pass another complete prohibition on carrying handguns, for example. But secondly, it also allows us to create a situation where we show the need for the Supreme Court to get involved. And finally, and not at all insignificantly, some of these cases, as strange as it sounds to say, may actually ultimately stand for, let's call it a low watermark proposition. This is as far as it could be taken. And that may sound a little bit crazy, but if you look at what happened to our gun laws over the last 100 years, and you think about what some of these people may be trying to do over the next 100 years, I think you'll see that that could be a very significant ramification of a lot of these cases we are bringing, even if they do not directly result in relief. And at that, I thank you for your time.
Eric, could I get you to come? I think if I remember your story, you went to Atlanta, you flew from Atlanta to Indianapolis, and you drove here?
Yes.
So another round of applause. Thank you.
Since David mentioned losing cases, I wanted to comment on that for a minute. Who here remembers the case Kelo versus New London, Connecticut? A little case involving eminent domain. That case was brought by a group called the Institute for Justice. And I got to listen to one of the lawyers for that group speak recently. And he pointed out that while they lost that case in the Supreme Court, they really have won that case because most states have now enacted laws that specifically prohibit what the Supreme Court attempted to allow in the Kelo decision. And so for that reason, sometimes when we lose gun cases, it can help. But in order for it to help, it requires you to be aware of them. It requires you to make sure your friends are aware of them. And it requires that we all make sure that the politicians that we elect to be our representatives hear what we think of those judges' decisions. Because at the end of the day, we do have three branches of government. When the courts don't get it right, the legislatures very often have the ability to make right what the court has messed up. 2 years ago, when I first spoke to this group, we had just gotten a law passed in Florida that after 25 years of ignoring preemption, we had put teeth into the preemption law. The legislature said that if cities and counties continue to ignore the law of preemption in firearms cases, they were going to do something about it. And they created a law that said we could hold certain individuals personally responsible for their actions in violating preemption. They said that those organizations would very often, or those individuals would very often be personally liable individually for their actions, and that their cities or counties would be responsible for the attorney's fees for the attorneys that had to come after them. 2 days after we filed that lawsuit, or after we got that, after that law went into effect, we filed our first lawsuit against the University of North Florida, and a few months later I came to GRPC to talk about this great new case that this new organization had filed to try and make sure that students going to and from campus at a commuter college would have the ability to defend themselves while they were traveling. In that case, we represented a young mother named Alexandria Linez, as well as Florida Carey, to get Ms. Linez the right to protect her young son as a single mom while traveling to and from her school. The day after we filed the lawsuit, the president of that college, a former mayor of our city, got on the radio and told the radio host it was just another example of a lawyer looking to make a buck. Well, it cost the University of North Florida somewhere just north of $130,000 of those bucks. We made a difference. Not only did we make a difference in that case, but less than 6 weeks later, a young man was attacked in his college parking lot at another college in the state. His attackers chased him as he ran to his car. They were using a pool cue to beat on him, but when he got to his car, he had a gun in his glove box, and he shot one of his attackers. The attacker lived, both attackers lived, as well as the young man who defended himself, but the school threatened to expel him for having a gun on campus despite a court decision only 6 weeks earlier. One day after filing our lawsuit, the college decided that they wanted to settle the lawsuit and notified the press that they had been in haste when they had said they would be expelling that student, and that nothing more would be done to the student who, because he was lawfully in possession of his firearm. So that was our big win. Since then, we've fought to defend the rights of individuals to stand their ground when attacked by, in one case, a convicted felon with a history of actually committing road rage and beating up other drivers. That case is currently before the Florida Supreme Court for oral arguments on December 2nd to decide whether a person who acts in self-defense should be required to prove that they acted in self-defense in order to have immunity under our stand your ground law, or whether it's the state's burden. Now, I'm not aware of any other situation of immunity where it's the individual's obligation to prove that they acted lawfully. Last time I checked, we had a right to be presumed innocent and that the state was obligated to prove us guilty. So hopefully the Florida Supreme Court will turn that around and fix that error. The second case is a case recognized in open carry. As I told one of our hosts from Illinois this morning, I've had to talk ugly about Illinois recently because whenever I talk on this subject, I have to tell people in Florida that I really don't enjoy being in the company of New York and Illinois when it comes to being three of the five states that prohibit open carry. In that case, Mr. Norman, a young man who had received his concealed carry permit that day, left his house, was walking down the street, but nobody had ever taught Mr. Norman how he needed to dress to carry a firearm. It's not one of the subjects that's covered in the mandatory concealed carry training in Florida. While we shouldn't have to have training to carry a gun, it's generally a good idea. But nobody had ever taught Mr. Norman, a 21-year-old young man, how to properly carry a gun. He didn't have an adult who had carried before to teach him. And so his gun became exposed as he was walking down the street. He was a felony stop was conducted on him by two police officers who immediately put him on the ground with guns drawn. And he was convicted of open carry of a firearm. Oral arguments in that case before the Florida appellate courts is on November 6th. And our most recent case is another college case. A gentleman named Bernie Mackin, who formerly was at the University of Utah and had to be forced by the Utah Attorney General to recognize Utah's preemption, decided after he had to leave Utah over that issue to come to Florida and continue his gun banning ways in Florida, which unfortunately still prohibits campus carry. So Mr. Mackin has decided that he's not going to abide by the decision of the Court of Appeals in the UNF case. He's going to continue to ban not only guns from cars, but stun guns that our law allows concealed carry holders to carry on campus, and pepper spray even. I don't know if any of you have seen the news in Florida, but we've had a rapist running around his university campus. He has attacked four or five women we're up to now. And so the school has taken some proactive steps. They've set up a booth in one of the main common areas. The booth has several signs warning people about the attacks, warning the young ladies at the school to be aware. Don't rape, get raped. Ways not to get raped. Don't flirt. Don't wear provocative outfits. That's what passes for security and what passes for self-defense and self-protection on the college campuses in Florida. We have filed suit to say that when the Supreme Court said that a person has a right to have a gun in their home, they meant it. It doesn't matter whether that home is owned by a university. The Fourth Amendment applies in university homes. That much has been held repeatedly by the courts. But for some reason, the Second Amendment doesn't. So we've asked the court to recognize the Second Amendment in those students' homes. We've asked the court to tell University of Florida that it must abide by the decisions of the courts and must allow those students to have guns in their cars and to use other lawful means that Florida law allows to defend themselves from the rapists that do sometimes happen on college campuses. Because this isn't the first time we've had a rapist or a killer on the University of Florida campus. And it's time that we all act to protect the rights of our young people, our students, our sons, our daughters, our nieces and nephews. If we don't act to protect them, both in litigation and in legislation, They will continue to be defenseless. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask David Siegel, since he has done cases for us in Nebraska, New Mexico, Oklahoma? No, not Oklahoma, and the Marianas Islands. So he has some interesting stories.
All right. Thank you, Julianne. Good afternoon. I do want to talk about those cases. I wanted to briefly talk about a little bit about what's going on here locally as well. I'm going to try and zip through it in 8.5 minutes. Okay. The Ezell case, Rhonda's here, where the Seventh Circuit struck down the City of Chicago's firing range ban in 2011, got replaced with a law allowing firing ranges, but with a whole host of restrictions that were so onerous that in 2014 you still don't see a public firing range in Chicago. So we continued the lawsuit, and about 35, 40 depositions later, and a mountain of documents submitted to the court on summary judgment, which is still pending on those issues. Some of them have, through circumstance, taken care of themselves. For example, Moore versus Madigan obviously struck down the ban on public carrying. Well, that meant that Chicago's ban in the firing range laws regarding carrying had to go out the window as well. When the state passed the Firearm Concealed Carry Act, one of the ramifications of that was that Chicago's CFP, anyone who had to deal with that piece of garbage, the Chicago Firearms Permit, and the Firearm Registry, those went out the window as well. So the laws that we were challenging in Ezell, regarding those laws, obviously those issues took care of themselves. More recently, back in January, the Illinois Association of Firearm Retailers case, federal judge, Judge Chang, said that Chicago's ban on gun stores was illegal. Well, when the city took 6 months to write a gun store law, one of the things they also did was they removed the ban on gun sales and firing ranges. So that was something we were challenging that no longer is being challenged. In all, about 20 challenges that we were making regarding firing ranges has been whittled down to about 8 to 10, I think. And the main one is still the issue that's going to it's going to resonate with those who are looking to open or patronize a gun store in Chicago. There's still virtually nowhere to put them. So between zoning and distance restrictions, you still don't see a firing range in Chicago for the public. You're going to see legal challenges regarding gun stores in Chicago, because it's not enough to just say on paper, sure, they're allowed. You actually have to allow them to exist. You have to create the means for them to exist, or at least not eliminate the means for them to exist. That's the situation that's still going on with firing ranges and gun stores in Chicago, and that's why Ezell is still going on, and that's why the Illinois Association of Firearm Retailers case, I suspect, is going to continue as well. So just another example of how sometimes the end is just the beginning. The Firearm Concealed Carry Act, of course, allowed Illinoisans to receive concealed carry permits. Thousands and thousands of people have applied and receive their permits, and good for you. Some people, hundreds, if not thousands, were denied. Now, some of them were denied for obvious reasons. you know, if they were convicted of some felony, violent felony, and hoping they were going to get away with it, well, the state police caught that and sent him a denial letter. But there was another situation that was a little more onerous. Some might have read about it in the newspapers. And if you were willing to read to about page 5 of that 5-page article all the way at the bottom, you might have seen my name. But, and if you did, if you were one of those few, thank you. But, what happened is that if you didn't have an obvious disqualifier, nonetheless, your name that in your application went to every law enforcement database in the state. And anyone who wanted to, is that, oh no, I still got, that's not for me, I still got 4 minutes. The any law enforcement who objected could register an objection. I don't think this is a savory person. And what happened is that objection would go to basically a secret panel called the Concealed Carry Licensing Review Board. And they could deny you and not say why they're denying you. Just you've been deemed a danger to yourself or others or public safety. You're being denied. Forcing people to go to court, like one of my clients who I finally yesterday heard in a telephone conversation with the other city's attorney why my client got objected to. She said, well, I can't give you the information, but let's sit on the phone and talk about it. They want to now remand a bunch of these cases. They saw, thanks to the newspaper article, the state has kind of seen the folly of secret review panels and secret decision-making process. And so they passed some emergency rules to allow people to find out more easily why they're being objected to and to give them a chance to respond. You only get 10 days. We'll see of how much of a problem that poses. I would suspect more than if they had, say, 30 or 60, but again, we'll see how it plays out. Anyway, this is all still in flux. So it's obviously an unfair process. It's being worked on, and we'll have to see what happens. Moving a little bit more nationally to what Julianne had mentioned, one of the more interesting things that I've been able to assist with SAF is the legal alien cases. Now, some people don't realize that legal aliens, lawful resident aliens, the ones with green cards, they have constitutional rights. And I don't mean just the constitutional rights of not to get beaten on by police when they get pulled over. You know, everyone enjoys those. But, you know, whether it works out that way is another story. But they all have that right. But legal aliens, lawful resident aliens, have virtually the same constitutional rights as citizens do. Except in a number of states when it comes to concealed carry permits. They have citizenship requirements. So we went to New Mexico and filed suit and received a earlier preliminary and then a permanent injunction saying that law was unconstitutional, that you can't, under the Equal Protection Clause, you can't discriminate on the basis of alienage for no other reason that they're legal aliens. And then we went to Missouri, where we filed suit and we lost in that we didn't lose the case. We lost an injunction motion, but on injunction motions, you get to appeal immediately. So literally days after we filed the notice of appeal, the state changed the law. And then we went to Nebraska and we filed suit there on the same issue. And a week later, a couple weeks later, they tried a motion to dismiss, which got denied. And then I get a call from the second in command at the Attorney General's office saying, hey, we heard what, the Attorney General really doesn't want to do this. We heard what you did in New Mexico. Can we just figure out some kind of injunction order just to get rid of this? Yeah, sure. If you pay us and you knock down your law, we'll be happy to. So that's what they did. And then we went to Arkansas, and they said, you know, I saw online that there was an order in the Nebraska case. Can we just enter the same order here? And that's what we did. And so it's a nice, now we're in North Carolina, and we'll hopefully see if they see the light. And it's a nice example of every once in a while when you see the dominoes rolling, when you get some good precedent and you get some good press out of it, and someone else sees you coming, kind of like a snowball gaining size, And, you know, sometimes, if you're lucky, that government official you're coming out after just really wants to get out of the way. If you want to talk, Julianne mentioned Marianas Islands. It's an interesting situation. I'll be around if anyone wants to talk about it. But for now, thank you very much for allowing me to talk. Thanks.
And now I'm going to have Esme Kotemski to come and take the mic, and he's going to do a wrap-up and give you a little bit of idea of some of the things SAF is doing.
I guess I'm a little taller than David Siegel.
Thanks for pointing that out.
Sue him.
So David was talking about the SAF cases and kind of the snowball effect where we start building on all these victories. And that's actually the topic I wanted to talk about as well. You know, earlier this year, pretty recently, we won a case in California on their 10-day waiting period to get a second handgun. And the court ruled that it didn't really make any sense for the state to stop somebody from getting a gun or make them wait 10 days when they already had one at home. It doesn't serve any purpose. The state was forced to try to justify their law, and they failed. Weeks ago, I guess it's 6 weeks ago now, in the District of Columbia, we got a decision in the Palmer case, which had been sitting there for about 4 years. And that ruling struck down D.C.'s outright ban on carrying firearms. Now, there's still a long way to go to realize the effects of that kind of decision, but the district is, you know, it's going to fight us. I feel confident that in the end we're going to win. But when I was reading the opinion in Palmer, the opinion in Sylvester, our 10-day waiting period case, I kind of had a realization, because I was reading all the citations, you know, legal decisions cite to other past legal decisions. And as I read through Palmer especially, and it's actually something I noticed in a Ninth Circuit carry case, Peruta as well, they kept citing back to cases that I really recognized. And each one I kind of knew, not just as a case, but as a person. They were all SAF cases, and it was, you know, stuff we've built over the last 4 or 5 years. Of course, they cited to Heller and McDonald, and our champion, Alan Gura, won those at the Supreme Court. Then the citations kept rolling in. I saw Illinois cases. I saw Rhonda Ezell versus City of Chicago. I saw Moore versus Madigan. You know, people who are here at GRPC. And it brought back seeing Otis McDonald at GRPC last time we were in Chicago. And when we were here, it was to celebrate our victory in McDonald, which got rid of the handgun ban. At the time, people came up to me and other SAF folks and said, "Wow, we won this. We're never going to see carry. That, you know, it's just a small victory. I really wish you guys had swung for the fences. We're never going to see carry." Well, a couple years later, here we are. Thanks to SAF and Illinois Carry and Alan Gura and David Jensen and David Siegel and many other people, there's probably at least a couple dozen of you sitting out in front of me right now with lawfully carried firearms. I think that's awesome. I love it. That carry law came about because of that snowball effect, building the stage that David Siegel was talking about through other SAF cases. Every day at SAF, we get calls from people who are in trouble. Their gun rights were violated. It makes me kind of angry to hear all the stories. They don't deserve the consequences that they face, and I wish we could really be there to help each and every one of them. And in the long run, the cases that we build and the snowball effect that we have, it will help all those people. Because our incremental victories are based on choosing the proper cases, the right plaintiffs, the right facts. A mentor once told me that, you know, judges in courts see lots of different cases, but really they see the same thing. It's two parties that are very, very passionate about whatever they're in court about. They're aggrieved, they're angry, they're fired up. And my mentor asked me, you know, who wins in these cases? Is it the person who's the loudest yeller, the most absolutist about their position, the hardliner? Not necessarily. It's usually the one that seems the most reasonable to the judge. You know, even if the judge isn't on our side, if we're not the crazy ones in the courtroom, like in California where they are trying to support a 10-day waiting period with really no evidence to back them up, we win. Otis McDonald was the right plaintiff for the right case. He was really the ripe fruit to bring an end to Chicago's handgun ban, the one to be chosen to do that. The other cases we have are in the same way. And I think SAF does an incredibly good job of reaching for those right cases, reaching for the ripe fruit without cutting down the whole tree at first. Now, I guess you would ask why I'm going into this. It's because of the story of how we find the right cases. The Otis McDonalds, the Michael Moores, the Rhonda Ezels. It's through the grassroots. It's through all of you. It's through people like Belinda Rowe, who I see right there. We find the right cases because we rely on each and every one of you when you find issues, when you have problems, to come to SAF and let us try to pick the right cases. So I guess I ask that when you have a case and you bring it to us, if we can't do it right now, it's because we're building that snowball. We're building the stage to get there. Don't get discouraged. We're with you. You know, hopefully registration, magazine restrictions, bullet type restrictions, all that will be when the snowball's so big that the gun banners can't get out the way of them. They'll get run over and we'll take care of that too. But more importantly, you have to keep, please, please keep bringing us your friends, your connections, your Otis McDonalds, your Michael Moores, your Rhonda Ezels, so that we can sort through all these cases and find the right ones. And so maybe next time we have GRPC in Chicago, we'll be talking about the end of FOID cards or registration or permits to exercise a constitutional right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. As always, it's informative, and it is really my pleasure as the Director of Operations at the Foundation to work